Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello, and welcome to episode 94 of Dogcast Radio. Later on, we have the Dogcast Radio news and the results of our Ziggy the Painting Dog competition. But first, we focus on author Sid Corpy and her book, Good Grief, Finding Peace After Pet Loss. Even if you haven't lost a pet, this book is an excellent preparation for that day and is told with warmth and includes so many intriguing stories, I would think any dog or indeed animal lover will enjoy it. I certainly did. It's a very uplifting book, and Sid starts by calling grief a rich experience, which seems an odd term, but she points out that grief is something you have to face up to. You can't shy away from it.
It's so true, and I appreciate that you see it as uplifting. I mean, there are plenty of places to cry and so forth, but the reason grief is rich is because it doesn't just encompass tears and sadness. It encompasses everything that you have that recalls for you your relationship with the animal or person, and you can't get yourself hung up on the early end of it, which is the more painful part, because then you can't adequately work through it to get to the part where you can remember, you can laugh, you can have that warm feeling around your heart because you know that that beloved creature is still with you. If you stop too soon in the grieving because you say, I dread it, I can't, it's too terrifying, it's too painful, then you end up stuffing all those emotions, and that erodes your health, and it erodes relationships, and it keeps you from fully committing to new ones. Like if you adopted a new pet, you might hold back a part of yourself because you didn't work through the entire experience.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as you say, the only way to avoid grieving is to sort of cut yourself off from attachments, which, you know, what's the point really then?
Mm-hmm. And we are particularly bad in Western societies because we are so afraid of any pain. Mm. That's why we have all these rampant addictions, because people are constantly saying, what can I take to deaden the pain, to help me escape, to keep me apart from who I am authentically inside? And you miss out on so much of really learning all you have to learn as a human being if you cut yourself off from those things. And it's such a shame.
Yeah, yeah. Now, very early on in the book, you ask people to make a list of people in their lives who have, for example, you know, never hurt them, never lied to them. The whole purpose of their life is you. And then you kind of say, now think of the animals that would fit that. And I think that brilliantly makes the point of why we mourn them so dreadfully when they've gone.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in my case, I don't think I could find a human name I could list.
Yeah.
When we talk about, you know, they're just there for you 24/7, and you come home and their eyes light up. And I mean, I've never known a human being to have that kind of relationship with another human being. I mean, if you have it, hang on to it. That's marvelous.
Yes.
But absolutely, you are so correct that if you have such a deeply bonded relationship, you have such a deep friendship and love and interdependence, and then that's ripped away, of course it's going to leave a gaping hole in your life. I mean, everywhere you walk through your house, your eyes go to a place that dog, that cat, that bird, whoever should be, and they're no longer there. Whereas if you've lost a human relative who lives across the country and you maybe send Christmas cards, that's not going to leave as big a hole. And it's not to denigrate human-to-human relationships. It's just, hey, guys, don't blow off the importance of the animal bond with the humans.
Yeah.
So that was my point there is, just, you know, really, it's pretty ludicrous for somebody to say that shouldn't matter to you when they pass. It's very ignorant to say.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Now, I mean, as you say, sometimes you can feel guilt that you have got this great wave of feeling of mourning for the animal, when, as you say, sometimes, you know, maybe a person, a family member or friend that you didn't see that often doesn't trigger the same response. And there are other ways that you know, this guilt can, other reasons, this guilt can come to you. I mean, one of the things that you point out, which is very relevant, we had a rabbit who I didn't realize was as ill as she was until very near the end. And you say, you know, don't beat yourself up if you didn't spot it.
No, animals have hundreds or thousands of years, depending on, you know, if it's a special breed that's just new. They have thousands upon thousands of years of ingrained behaviors that say, I must mask if I'm ill, or my pack or my pride or my flock will know I'm ill and they'll attack me to get rid of me so that the pack and so forth can survive. So they have it ingrained in them oftentimes to act like, no, everything's fine, I'm feeling much better, you know, when they're really not. Mm. And so if you miss it, you can't fault yourself. I mean, it's one thing if you do something flagrant, like leave them outside under the porch and it's 32 degrees below zero, because I'm in Minnesota, it happens. Then if your pet suffers from that, well, then you have brought it on yourself. But in the regular course of things, I mean, yes, you can notice if they've vomited or something, and if you ignore the fact that they're doing that daily, you might have something to look at in yourself and say, okay, I really turned a blind eye to that because I didn't want to know the answer. But otherwise, there are so many ways and so many times they are experts at not letting you know how bad off they are until it's to the point where you really can't do anything. And maybe that's a blessing, that you don't have to make so hard a judgment call, because they make sure that it's pretty clear, this is my end. And maybe that's a loving way they handle it for us. I don't know.
I mean, obviously, when you do have to make the decision and euthanize, it's, again, it's a horrendous decision to have to make. And, there's a very nice quote from Eleanor L. Harris in your book. And she says, it takes the greatest love, devotion and courage to end a suffering life. And I think people have to bear that in mind, don't they?
Absolutely. It is a selfless act to say, I am willing to set free my best friend, knowing it means I will not physically have him or her in my life anymore. That's what's so hard, where people will, you know, hold on and say, I can't make the decision. It's less about, I'm afraid this will hurt my pet to put him or her to sleep. It's more about, I can't face life without you. Mm. And our pets will actually, because they love us so much, they will oftentimes just hang in there. They'll suck it up. They'll be in pain, but they'll say, no, Mom can't get by without me or whatever. And they hang in. And if you know that you are prolonging the suffering of someone you love so dearly, wouldn't you purposely say, I have to let them go when it's their time? And that's why it is. And it does take courage. This is not easy. I didn't name it Good Grief, Have a Swell Time Killing Your Pet, because it's not easy.
No.
It's just horrific, but it can be beautiful at the same time.
Yeah.
When you experience it with them, and you're there to love them and hold them and wish them well and say goodbye.
Yeah. I mean, as you point out, we have this fear of death, but they don't have that.
No. Oh, I envy them so.
Mm-hmm.
They have so much about them, and their existence is a beautiful metaphor for what we should be learning as humans, how to live in the moment, how to accept where you're at right now. I had a vet who pointed out something really good to me. My West Highland White Terrier, Mortimer, had severe degenerative arthritis. And I thought, oh, no, he's in such pain, and, you know, he's all stiff. Look, he walks like a cowboy. His legs are so smooth. And he said, you know, he doesn't sit around feeling sorry for himself like we would. He just says, you know, I want to get over there to that bone. Do hobble, hobble, hobble. Hey, I got there. Cool.
Yeah.
You know, and really, if we put it in our mindset, that they view it like that. It's like, here's my need. Can I meet it? Great. And as long as they're not in tremendous pain, they adapt to so much without complaint.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
You've just reminded me, though, we went to a place called the Alternative Animal Sanctuary, where Tamara does tremendous work there. And there was a German shepherd who had lost the use of her back legs, and she was on a cart at the back. And, you know, when I was telling my mum about this, who has sort of quite traditional views, and she was saying, oh, I couldn't do that to a dog, I couldn't do that. And I said, no, listen, the dog can get around, you know. And there was a whole pack there, you know, for want of a better word. There was, she did have several dogs. None of the other dogs, you know, cut her any slack at all. She was just another dog. She didn't cut them any slack, you know, and she could keep up with the pack with these wheels. And the funniest thing was, there was a little Jack Russell, very sweet little dog. And when he saw this German shepherd coming his way, he would just roll up in a ball. She would bounce over him with the wheels, and then he'd jump up and off he went after her. And they were having a ball. They didn't know any different, you know, they didn't know there was anything different from normal.
Oh, absolutely. They don't treat each other like freaks, you know. It's just, hey, again, you're meeting my criteria. I need to run and play, and here you are playing with me.
Yeah.
I'm great with that. And they're so accepting. It comes down to those questions of how far are you willing to go medically to help an animal who's in crisis. If they're hit by a car, if it's internal injuries that can't be saved, then you should probably put them to sleep. If it's something, you know, even as awful as losing a limb, if they can adapt and you can afford to intervene medically, perhaps you should consider that. But it's all a very personal choice. And we have to be careful, again, not to superimpose our anthropomorphic notions of this would be a bad quality of life for me, so therefore it is for my dog or for my cat or, you know, so forth.
Yeah. Now, what I like about this book is you offer sort of hope from your experiences. There are so many submitted stories. So, you know, almost whatever pet you have, you can identify with people in there. And as well, there is so much practical advice. It's brilliant. And one of the things I have...
I love you, Julie. Can I take you home and make you my best friend?
Oh, yes. I like the sound of that. I've read about you, and I like the sound of your house. But one of the practical things that I'd not thought about was, you know, if you don't see the death, you know, ask to see the body, you know, because as you say, if you haven't seen it, you know, did it really happen? There's all this kind of emotion going on.
Right. I have an aunt whose husband passed away, and she has refused to have open casket, and she refuses to go to his grave because she wants to pretend in her mind he's still alive. And that's like taking things to an extreme. I mean, that's the ultimate in denial of grief. But you can have that. Say a pet ran out and got hit by a car and was brought in by someone else and died in the vet's office. If someone just calls and says, Sparky's gone, you know, oh, thank you, Blanche. If someone calls and says that your dog is gone, do you just go, oh, okay, I accept that? Well, maybe you can with your head, but there's a part of your heart, your whole internal workings have to make a connection of some sort, whether it's to see the pet or to stroke it or to bring it home with you, you know, whatever. I mean, everyone has a different degree of how close they can get to that. Yeah, I mean, there are unique circumstances where it's not so much that there's this big conspiracy that someone has stolen your animal and just made up the lie so that they could run off with it. It's not an X-file. It's just more that you need to have all your senses experience that it's truly gone, you know, and you can accept it.
It's closure, isn't it, really?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Closure in the I will accept that they're gone, there really isn't true closure with grief, because it's a real cyclical thing. You'll think, oh, I've gone through this, I had my memorial service, I'm done, and then months or years later something will trigger it and you're like blubbering all over again. You go, where did this come from? Well, because they're so deeply in our hearts, that every so often a new layer pops out.
Mm.
And part of the good grief is knowing that each time you do that, you've gotten a little stronger. You've gotten a little bit more in touch with who you are as a human. You've opened your heart a little bit more to compassion and acceptance and all these things. So none of it is bad, even though you can't say, oh, I guarantee in 30 days after you've read my book, you'll never cry again over this pet. Oh, I would never say that.
No.
You know, they're too important to us.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, it's little things that spark it off. My mum had a German Shepherd who she adored and we all loved, and he had to be put to sleep. And the first time we were on holiday and I saw this guy with a German Shepherd and thought, right, I have to go over and say hello to the German Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a beautiful, friendly dog, put the ball on the floor and looked up at me like, you know, come on, play.
Uh-huh.
And it was very familiar eyes looking up at me. And I just
felt, oh, yeah.
And I thought, well, I can't stand here and cry in front of a complete stranger. You know, I have to either walk away.
Oh, I would. I wouldn't be able to help it.
Well, yeah. But I thought, I have to walk away or I have to sort of, you know, pull myself together here. And so I tried to pull myself together and sort of and talk to him for a bit. But, you know, it's you can't predict. I thought that was going to help me. And I suppose, as you say, it did. But it just touched a place I didn't expect it to. And I kind of thought, you know, yeah.
And you absolutely can't say for sure that your mother's German Shepherd didn't kind of, just for a moment, borrow that dog. Just to say, I want to connect with her, and I'll just give this little bit of my soul there, flash through the eyes, she'll see it and feel it and know I love her. You know, that can happen. I mean, it's all a matter of how open you are to those kinds of things. And it's nothing wrong if you say, that's just too freaky, I would never want that. But a great many of us, even if we're nuts, even if this is not true, if you need it and you see and feel it and make that connection and you feel better as a result, who is harmed by that?
Yeah.
But I, at the same time, I have had far, far, far too many of these kinds of afterlife connection experiences to keep saying, oh, I doubt that it's true. You know, I think it was part of my purpose in life to have so many of them, to just finally go, I better tell somebody about these. You know, there's got to be someone else out there who's said, you know, I had that same thing happen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, your book is fascinating just from that point of view, you know, all those experiences that you've had.
And it just scratches the surface. Ugh.
Yeah.
I'm good at, you know, sitting around campfires telling ghost stories.
I bet you are.
They're not really scary, though. Everyone gets really disappointed because there's no hook hanging on the car or something. It's like, no. And then they just blew out this candle and I could tell that their love was there. And they're like, uh-huh.
Oh, dear. Another point that you make about if you do have to euthanize your pet is when you schedule it.
Oh, yeah. If you have a choice, try not to make it on your birthday, your anniversary, or Christmas, or whatever major holiday. I know of many people who they've given up celebrating milestones in their life because they've connected that date with a very sorrowful occasion like the euthanasia of their pet. And I think that's really a shame. I mean, sometimes you obviously do not have a choice. Every time recently that I've had a pet who needed to go, it was the night before Thanksgiving, or it was on a Sunday when, you know, you might say, well, I'll just hang on until Monday. It'll be cheaper at the regular vet. Well, when you see it and they're saying, my need is now, you need to do it.
Yeah.
And there is no way to justify waiting. I couldn't possibly. But yeah, if you can avoid connecting it with something that you know every time it comes around you're going to go, oh, ouch, I remember this. You know, do what you can to keep that apart if you have that kind of leeway.
Yeah. Now, another section which I thought was so helpful was visualizing, you know, when you're in a situation where it's called when other people let you down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when sort of somebody turns around and goes, well, it was only a dog. And, you know, my response would be, you know, it's only my fist then.
Oh, thank you. I was visualizing that fist.
And you know, okay. But that's me. But you help people not do that.
Yeah, I mean, my name is Sid, but vicious. Well, sometimes yes, but no, it could lead to, you know, lawsuits and arrests if you do that. So it might be a better thing to almost role play in your head. What will I say when I'm around this person I know is just going to be, well, frankly, an ass, and say these kinds of things. First of all, if you can avoid them, wonderful. Stay away until your major part of your grief is past and you feel a little more in control. Or try not to mention the loss around that person because you just know there's going to be nothing good coming from them. But there's a, I think it's rational emotive therapy or something, where you mentally walk through a circumstance that would make you very, very upset and kind of spin you out of control. And you look at it more from a logical perspective, where it's a rational way to see it and say, when they're saying, oh, forget your grief, this was just an animal and everything, they're saying far more volumes about themselves than they are you or your pet. There's... Yeah, it's like what you think of me is none of my business kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, secretly think, I really pity you that you don't have any comprehension of this incredibly rich and wonderful and loving bond that you can have with a pet. You're going to go through your whole life without experiencing that, and I'm sorry for you. And if you can kind of look at it that way ahead of time, I mean, granted, we can't always avoid these situations, and so it can only help to a certain degree, but if you can prepare that way, or if you can, say, you have to go to work or whatever, if there's a way to take a personal day or some sort of vacation day, for the first few days, even. Just do it, you know. Pretend you have a really bad hangnail and you have to stay home. Do it to take care of yourself, because it's hard, too, for people who can't handle grief, even in themselves or anyone else, when they feel awkward and ill at ease because they see your raw emotion. Even very kind people will sometimes just kind of back away because, you know, they don't have a degree in grief counseling. And then you can, if you're really in the throes of the grief, you can say, well, they weren't there for me. Well, it was really hard to be because they didn't know how to help. And so that whole chapter is kind of like trying to take the perspective of the one who's watching you fall apart. And realize they may not be horrible people. There may be a lot of legitimate reasons they don't have a bond with animals. But that doesn't mean they get to denigrate your experience. And so you can protect yourself from that.
That's a fantastic chapter, because as I say, my response might not have been as nice as it might be otherwise, having read that and thought, yes, okay, I think I could I could do.
Oh, I've thrown back my share of snarky responses. Now, I mean, when you're writing, you can sound all intellectual.
You see, that would be my way of role playing it. What's the, you know, what can I say in the nicest tone that will cause the most hurt back? You know,
that's exactly. You point out their true and deep character flaws as human beings.
Yeah.
But sound pleasant while we do it.
But I mean, it is, you know, that was so useful, though, to actually think ahead, think it through. How are you going to cope? And to realize, you know, you may well encounter that.
More likely than not.
This interview with Sid Corpy continues after the news.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Ancient Egyptians loved their dogs so much that they were buried in family tombs, and family members would shave their heads in mourning. Dog mummies were made with great care and expense.
Hello and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Nick.
And I'm Kate. We start with the sad news that the tallest dog in the world, Gibson the Great Dane from California, has died. He was born in April 2002 and grew up and just kept on growing until he reached the record-breaking height of 42.6 inches at the shoulder and 7 foot 1 inch standing up on his hind legs. Gibson was bred by Sandy Hall, and together they appeared on The Oprah Winfrey Show, The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and Good Morning America, amongst many others. You can hear the Dogcast Radio interview with Sandy in episode 18. Sadly, in April 2009, Gibson lost his right front leg to bone cancer, and despite chemotherapy, on the 7th of August he passed away.
He was a big dog with a big heart, and he made a big impression during his too short life. We hope he rests in peace. In the UK recently, a dog was lucky enough to survive after she got stuck in a fox trap in a field, and it was only the British weather that saved her. Poor Bessie, a black Labrador, was imprisoned for 3.5 weeks, and apparently only survived by drinking rainwater, something there's been no shortage of this summer in the UK, fortunately for Bessie. Finally, a walker discovered her, and she is now safely back at home. It's a warning of the dangers our dogs can encounter when allowed out alone. As Bess's owner admitted, the dog often took herself off to a family member's house half a mile away.
Meanwhile, one Israeli woman was so reluctant to let her dog out of her sight that she forked out an astonishing amount for her dog to fly alongside her. The woman, known only as Rivka, refused to put her boxer dog Orchuk in the cargo hold and instead came to an arrangement with the airline El Al. For a 4-hour flight from Paris to Tel Aviv, several seats were removed and 8-year-old Orchuk travelled in a crate. The cost of such luxury? A whopping $32,000. And we're not told whether drinks and food were included in that price.
In Cornwall, England, poor old lifeguard Bilbo, a Newfoundland, is still banned from the beach, while his overseas counterparts are hard at work. In Italy, 300 dogs are now licensed to help save lives at beaches and lakes. As well as Newfoundlands, the canine lifeguards include Labradors and Golden Retrievers. Already the dogs are credited with helping to save 7 lives. The dogs are initially trained to tow their instructor in the water, and as a measure of their strength, the largest number of people a dog has been able to simultaneously tow in the water is 40.
But in Melbourne, Australia, it was a dog who needed rescuing from the sea. Tiny Maltese Shih Tzu cross Bibby was out for a walk on the pier with his owner Sue Drummond when a strong gust of wind blew him clean off the pier and into the rough sea below. Sue watched horrified as her dog struggled to swim for shore, but a handy hero took action. Raden Soimawinitter was on the pier with his family to scatter his grandmother's ashes, but when he spotted the small dog in the water, he stripped down to his shirt and underpants and lowered himself into the sea. Poor Bibby was soon back in Sue's arms, thoroughly wet, but none the worse for his brush with danger. And brave Raden was quite rightly being hailed as a hero.
And the moral of the story is don't walk your dog on a pier in high winds without the aid of a sturdy leash. And that's all from us on the Dogcast Radio News Desk. Goodbye.
Tibetans believe that dogs are closest to humans in reincarnation and that high lamas especially often reincarnate as dogs. Our interview with Sid Corpy, author of Good Grief, Finding Peace After Pet Loss, continues now with some of Sid's very personal experiences of pet loss.
Obviously, you've written this book from, you know, a lot of experience, as you say, a tsunami
yeah.
of
Oh my gosh, yes.
Now, the one of the things that really intrigued me is you asked your two of your dogs who had already passed over to choose your next dog for you, didn't you?
Yes, I had had experience in the past where a pet had died, and then for a Christmas present I got a gift certificate for the Humane Society, and I just broke down crying, and I felt like, oh my God, this is already betraying the other animal. Oh. I'm not loyal. I'm not replacing you. Oh, you know. And I went through a lot of heck with that. So this time I said, I don't want that to happen again. And I do know I need to have another pet in my life, another dog in this case. So when my Westie Ludwig passed away in 2005, I asked him and Tuppence, who had died about 3 years earlier, also a Westie, to help us. We held an all pets memorial service after Ludwig passed. We thought, okay, we could hold a funeral just for him, but you know, let's make it bigger than that. Let's invite everybody and have them bring pictures of their own past pets, and we'll all share stories, and it'll be really uplifting for all of us. And so we had 30 human beings come to this thing, and they brought photos. One lady brought a picture of her St. Bernard from 50 years before, and we were able to just share and talk, and I made Westie-shaped cookies and all this. And every person who came in wrote the name of their pets on a little card that said, in loving memory of, and put it on a card tree and lit a candle. Well, then we left that up for most of the month of December because he died right before Thanksgiving. And then on New Year's Eve, my husband and I took every single one of those cards and said a prayer to the animal that was listed there and put it in our fireplace, you know, to kind of send out messages and thanks and all that. And then we sat down and we wrote a very detailed, itemized list of this is what we want in our next dog. And could you guys do the shopping for us? And we put that out on January 1st, and by January 3rd, we found Mortimer. He was on Pet Finder, and he was a stray that was rescued in Humane Society in Jamestown, North Dakota. Sight unseen, I mean, other than the pictures, we said, okay, that's our dog, we know. Because we have this certainty. It's like if you're trying to force something to be, something will go wrong, and it'll just feel wrong, and you're denying yourself if you turn a blind eye to that. But when it's right, it just goes plunk right into the right spot, and you go, yeah, that's it. So we went and adopted him because we wanted a younger dog, a young adult. So this one said he was 3, and we said, okay, that's fine. Except when we got there, the records changed to he's 4. Then when we got him home and took him to the vet for a check, they said, well, he's got all these broken teeth and he's got degenerative arthritis. I don't think he's quite 10.
Oh, Christ.
And it's like, how could you have gotten this so wrong?
Oh.
And then we realized, no, they didn't get it wrong. They had to keep us in the dark because otherwise we wouldn't have traveled 6 hours to get this dog, and he was perfect for us.
Mm.
He was such an angel. Plus, I think he and Ludwig were in cahoots because Ludwig's passing started the whole thing because at his memorial, someone said, you know, you should write a book about how to memorialize your pets, and that planted the seed. And then Mortimer passed away just after I finished the book and turned in the pages to be designed.
Yeah.
And he became the epilogue. And so one dog was a catalyst, and the other one was the Epa dog. Oh, sorry, guys. I'll understand if you mark on me. But, yeah, I mean, when all this happened, and you can kind of get a sense of there was a cosmic design here. Something was divinely in play, and you get this sense, a profound sense, that these wonderful angelic animal spirits chose you, and at the time and in the circumstances they did, for a reason. And it was like, oh my God, he signed on to be with us for only a little over 3 years. But it was so intensely loving and bonded. He was just phenomenal. Just adored him. Well,
yeah,
all of them, but oh, he was so, so special. And, you know, I choke up thinking, oh, this was such a gift.
Yeah.
And that's why I know Ludwig and Tuppence helped us do that, because, you know, we wouldn't have found him. We would never have driven all that way if they hadn't said, we're going to put these nice little blinders on you so you won't know, because then when you get him back and you love him to pieces, it won't matter.
Yeah.
And it'll give me that huge lesson in living in the here and now and not preemptive mourning all the time, going, oh my God, he's so much older. And, you know, I did a bit of that, but I learned to scale back and say, you're here now and I adore you.
Yeah, which is the important thing, isn't it? You know,
oh, yes. And, and so much easier to say than to do.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've mentioned a very important aspect, you know, you've showed us a very important aspect of the book there, because there is this sort of You don't call it supernatural, do you? Is it supernormal, you call it?
Supernormal, yes. Yeah. I found that definition really worked because it all, whatever happens, it conforms to the laws of nature. It's just so astoundingly different than what you would normally see or experience, but that's what makes it super.
Yeah. But I mean, you often know your next pet's name, and you sort of recognize them rather than finding them, kind of thing. It's
quite hard, isn't it? It's an amazing feeling. It really, really is. When I got Tuppence, I dreamed of her. And I woke up and told it was my first husband, and I said, I just dreamed of Tuppence. I saw her, and I knew exactly what she looked like. And sometimes a name will just sort of bubble up and feel right, or we'll knock around favorites. We often tend to we're Anglophiles sometimes, and we like to throw out names that are kind of like that, you know, Nigel, Basil, you know, this. And we keep them in the offing, you know, just saying, we're open to this, and we'll see who shows up. But I remember we were trying to think of the name we would give Mortimer to rescue him from the name Sir Chucky, which they had given him at the shelter. I could only think of the horror movie Child's Play with the Chucky doll. I thought, oh my gosh, I got to change this. But I remember my husband was braiding my hair, of all things, and he takes so long, I just sort of get self-hypnotized going, duh. And while I was sort of in that in and out of daydream state, I just suddenly said, Mortimer. And I looked at him, and he's like, oh, yeah, because he was being named for Cary Grant's character in Arsenic and Old Lace. Mm. And the point of that being he was so happy to find out he was adopted and wouldn't genetically inherit the insanity of his two aunts, you know. Yeah. And so I thought, oh, that's so appropriate. And Mortimer, it was.
Yeah.
And yet when we adopted Blanche, shortly after Mortimer, she was just this little peanut that came with the name Zoe. And we thought, okay, well, we'll try that. And we called her that. She wouldn't respond. Called her Zoe, 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 nothing. I hadn't pre-thought anything because we thought we would try to keep that name. And all of a sudden, I was standing in my yard with her, and I said, hey, what about Blanche? She stopped dead, looked at me, and went tearing around the yard and tearing around the yard and tearing around the yard.
Aww.
And I guess that's her name, you know, and it's that kind of thing. Sometimes we've chosen the name and we kind of like get this sense that we will find the ones that fit this, and it won't be ambiguous. It won't be, oh, should I, maybe it's this one or that one. And, you know, no, well, no, it's just flat out. Oh yeah. That's who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, a lot of the time when you introduce your animals, you know, you bring a new animal home, they just have a quick sniff and then get on, don't they?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I hear so many people say, we brought home these animals, we had to separate them for a month and, you know, keep muzzles on them forever until they adjusted. And maybe that's because in that household, there's a lesson to be learned in that whole thing. I don't know. It might be some, you know, big thing for the humans to figure out. But here, it's just a given that if you are being welcomed into our home and us into your life, we're meant to be. Mm-hmm. And when they come in, my cat Giles is so scaredy cat. Anybody comes in, he runs away. Yet before Ludwig passed, Giles and he started hanging out together a lot in the last month before Ludwig passed. And I didn't even know he was sick with prostate cancer until 2 weeks before he died. He wasn't acting sick. And we would see Ludwig would jump on the couch and look out the window and bark at passersby. Giles would get up on the couch and stand next to him on the pillow looking out the window. Mm-hmm. And he started doing this over and over. And once Ludwig passed, Giles continued it. It's like he got trained in as watch cat for the time between Ludwig and Mortimer. But it got to be a little too much for him, and he got very nervous and started pulling out tufts of his hair. He said, I'm doing the best I can, but I'm not a dog. And so we got Mortimer. He came right down, sniffed, and said, oh, thank God, next troop is here. You know, and they were just instantly, absolutely fine with each other, very mellow. And And he was relieved of his guard duty, and that was all A-OK with him.
Aww.
We thank him very much for all his efforts to keep our house safe.
Oh, bless him. That sounds lovely. Oh, again, as part of the practical advice in the book, you offer so many memorializing methods. You know, could you tell us about a few of them?
You've got things like getting their paw print or nose print at the vet when you have them euthanized. I had never had that opportunity until Ludwig, and now I wouldn't pass it up. It's just wonderful to see their little footsie in clay. What I tend to do when I'm in mourning is I kind of channel my feelings through artsy, craftsy things, and I will draw things, I will paint things, even if it's, some people will like to have a memorial stone. Maybe you just find a really lovely rock and paint your dog or cat's name on it, or just the activity of creating something in someone else's memory is healing and distracting and creative. It's all a positive thing. I had, other people write stories or songs or poems. They keep diaries. You may hold a memorial service like we did. And that can be as small as you and your family, or you can open it up to people. Everybody's different in how they want to mourn. My husband's aunt and uncle had a private funeral for their schnauzer, but a couple days later, they held a memorial service for her and had the humans come.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I advise them, don't invite the ones you know who won't get it.
Yeah.
You don't have to be angry at them or have any ill will, but just don't put yourself through it or them.
Mm-hmm.
Just invite the people you know it resonates with. And I really loved the way that the author Lillian Jackson Braun worked through her grief. She had a Siamese cat named Coco that some horrid person murdered by throwing off a 10-story balcony. And to get through her grief, she wrote a novel called The Cat Who, and then dot, dot, dot.
Oh.
And she has written, I don't even know, it could be 100 or more of these novels about this prescient Siamese cat named Coco who helped solve mysteries with his owner, James Quillerin.
Oh.
And so it's The Cat Who, I've got a list of them here, The Cat Who Knew a Cardinal, The Cat Who Lived High, The Cat Who Went Underground, and, all of this, and she memorialized Coco, worked through her anger, and turned the tables on that horrible, cruel person by creating a cat character who solved these crimes and put these people in jail and so forth. And they're really charming books, and that just shows you taking it to an extreme of how your whole life can change by having your pets influence you this way. I mean, for instance, there's this crazy person I know who just wrote a book on grief, it's been very healing. I think I didn't really need the irony of having Mortimer die to prove to myself I knew what I was talking about, but it was still good to feel inside, I'm not steering anyone wrong here. I did use the things I researched and learned and read from other people. And it helped me to get, standing upright, not doubling over in pain and tears, a lot faster than if I hadn't had all this. So.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mention in the book when the loss is reversed. So the person is going before in this case, the dog. And again, that was something I hadn't really thought of, in a personal way like that. And that's a really touching story of how, the dog moves on in that case.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it was really hard for my friend Mavis, who was in hospice care with her Pekingese Zeke. He would lie next to her in her hospital bed, and it got so that he would not leave her side willingly. He wouldn't eat. He wouldn't go out to go potty. He had to be by her. He couldn't miss that moment when she would pass. And she couldn't pass until she felt sure she had Zeke taken care of. So there was this whole oddly symbiotic relationship there. And, you know, he would growl if you tried to take him outside and everything. But the only time he got rest was if he were lying between her legs on the bed, because then he could be assured she couldn't get up without his knowing. And it was when she worked out the details and knew he was going to go with her foster daughter, then she was able to go. And then as soon as she passed, Zeke was a new dog. Mm. He was like, oh, okay. That's over. My job was to make sure I stayed with her, but now I see she's okay. Yeah. And he was perky and fine again. And what was lovely is she made the situation so he could get better faster, and so could her foster daughter, who would then have a piece of her foster mother in Zeke. And, you know, so just the idea of, it's one thing if you know you're terminally ill and you work this out. It's a whole other thing to think ahead, like as you would if you were having a living will or something, where you're well now, but what if a sudden stroke or heart attack or a car accident or whatever happened? Mm-hmm. You know, then what happens to your pets? I have a menagerie of 6 pets right now. I would not want them to just be, you know, left up in the air. So don't just figure, oh, my sister so-and-so will take them, and, you know, I don't have to ask. Get permission from that friend or that family member or that neighbor and say, can I put in writing that if I pass, you will be the custodian for my pets? And if you, at that time, can't keep them, you will do all you can to get them a proper, loving home. Mm. You know, so it'd be like a foster until another home can be found.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people are setting up trusts. I mean, Leona Helmsley is a little on the extreme, if you've heard of her.
But, yes, oh yes.
But the idea is sound. Mm. You know, leave enough money so that whoever is inheriting your pets doesn't have to undergo hardship. Because if they don't have enough money to feed themselves, they're not going to feed your pet either. Mm. And so it's tough stuff to look ahead to, but it would be so valuable to have in writing so that there's no ambiguity, and then you don't have to worry. Your pets really will be taken care of.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I know you have some very practical pointers in the book, sort of, you know, go and ask the vet if I'm leaving this person, you know, a dog, a cat, whatever it is, what's a reasonable amount, you know,
right,
of money to leave to them. So there's very good practical advice that you've got.
Yes, sometimes we have to face those nuts and bolts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to, I mean, we've done it. We have a daughter, and you have to do it then. And it's heartbreaking to think. But, you know, your pets need that just as much. You know, what's going to happen to them? And it, as you say, it is something you need to think through.
Absolutely. And until they grow opposable thumbs and can open their own cans of food, they really need a human.
Yes. One of the important points that you make, sort of, about moving on after loss, because it's a very human thing to think, no, I don't want to move on. I just want to, you know, wallow in my grief. I don't, you know, and you point out it's not betraying the animal that you've lost. It's honoring them to sort of move forward and, you know, perhaps have another dog or another, you know, cat, whatever. It's actually honoring their memory.
Absolutely. Because what you are putting forth there is you're saying, I learned what you taught me. I learned to love that deeply, and I have a big heart, and it's overflowing with love. It's got to go to somebody. Help me find a new somebody that needs this. And that's the way you honor them, because they are here doing a job. And if you ask them to help you find a new pet, that's continuing their job. It gives them a sense of purpose. I just know that I've really changed my viewpoint on whether or not I was betraying an animal by taking another one in. But you are not replacing. The only time you might be replacing one is if you knee-jerk, oh, so-and-so died, I'm going out tomorrow and getting a new one.
Mm.
That can, for some people it may work, but by and large, that's too soon.
Mm.
And you are going to be looking unrealistically to that new pet to replace and be just like your perfect creature that just died. They'll be imperfect, just as your perfect one was imperfect, but you're not seeing it that way. But they'll be imperfect in their own wonderful ways. And you've got to be at a point where you've worked through the worst of the grief so that you can look at them and value them for who they actually are as individual beings. Mm. And not say, okay, well, I don't like you as much because Sparky would have done this, but you did it this way.
Yeah.
You know, can't do that. That's not fair to them or you, and it's just stifling the true emotional bond that can be there.
Yeah, yeah. See, I try and cheat at this point because, you know, I kind of, if I lost a dog, I wouldn't know at what point, you know, was it okay to get another one? So I try and cheat and bring another one in at some point, you know, so that there's overlap. So I'm not thinking, you know, I'm replacing. I'm thinking, look, I love you both. And you know, you've gone, but I've got you to help me through it kind of thing. So I try
that
to get around.
That's actually very wise. And thank you for bringing it up, because I think that's another reason that when Mortimer passed, I was able to get on with things a little bit faster and easier than I was with Ludwig, because at the time, Ludwig was the only dog in the house.
Yeah.
And when he was gone, silence. Mm. And the emptiness was just devastating to me. Mm. Whereas when Mortimer passed, we had already adopted Blanche. And then when we saw Mortimer was kind of slowing down and Blanche had a lot of puppy energy, but she was slowing down with him. Mm. We said, we need another young dog for Blanche.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, that kept her puppy side alive. And Mortimer would even play occasionally, not for big, long duration, but it was unbelievably adorable when he would.
Yeah.
And now Blanche and Keeley are our two Westies. And it got me, so I said, okay, I don't get to lie in bed and cry and cry and cry because they need me to let them out, you know, and it pulls you out of yourself. And I think it added fun and youth for Mortimer for a time.
Yeah.
Plus, it gave him the release that said, you don't have to be mom's only dog.
Yeah.
You don't have to bear that burden. These two are here to help. So when you need to move on, you go ahead. And he actually kind of went downhill and aged pretty quickly after we brought Keeley in, I think for that reason. We don't know for sure how old he was. We're guessing 12 or 13 by that point.
Mm.
But, yeah, you look at pictures from when we first got the puppy. We got all these photos taken, and they were all just stunningly cute and wonderful. Within months, you could see how he'd aged.
Mm.
I mean, really, really fast. And so I don't regret getting Keeley at all. I know that that was part of the kind of the sacred contract that they'd all worked out.
Mm.
And, you know, there's a wisdom beyond us that says, okay, this is how you've chosen to cast your life, and here's your new cast members, and here's how it's going to play out. And you know, we're taking direction we don't even realize.
I think part of the reason this book is so good is that, you know, as we've said, you're not writing about grief sort of from an academic viewpoint. You've gone through it. You have experienced this. And I mean, you know, you've said you cried every day writing it. My goodness, the epilogue with Mortimer. Oh, well, that I had it. I was crying buckets of tears at that point. I mean, it's beautiful, but it is so moving.
Mortimer thanks you for caring enough about him to cry.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is beautiful, and I do recommend people go and read that. It's lovely, although it's poignant, you know. But I think you are proof that you can survive this grief and you can move forward, can't you?
Oh, in a 5-year span, I'd lost my mother, my stepfather, my stepuncle, my dog Tuppence, my Siamese cats, Dudley and Genevieve, my cockatiel Samantha, and my 15-year marriage.
Mm.
And that's why I call it a tsunami. There was nothing left after that. And if you find a way to continue, and you don't just say, everyone who ever loved me is on the other side, why shouldn't I be with them?
Mm.
That's a key thing. I was helped to find a way to say, I need to stay on this side because I'm not done.
Mm.
Whatever I have to do is not done yet, so I have to find a way to find that strength. And bless their souls, all my animals have helped me to do that, probably more so than the people in my life. they would go the good argument for leaving. But no, they anchored me here as they needed to. Mm. And I definitely found I could survive. And what's kind of interesting in a little quirky way, in high school, they would give us these aptitude tests to find out what career you were supposed to be suited for. Mm. Well, when they gave me mine, I laughed. It said you should be in advertising or a funeral director. And now, 47 years into my life, I'm doing both.
Oh, I like it. So they were right.
I'm finally where I'm supposed to be.
She definitely is where she's supposed to be, and she's going to help so many people come to terms with and prepare for the loss of a beloved pet. You can find out more at Sid's website, www.goodgriefpetloss.com. And when you buy the book there, the price includes a $2 donation to a no-kill shelter. And you can specify the inscription you would like Sid to write in your book. It's an amazing book about amazing experiences, and I wish Sid lots of success with it. The indigenous people of the Americas revered dogs, which were treated like family members and often accorded burial and mourning rites. You've been entering our Ziggy the Painting Dog competition, but if you haven't entered yet, it's too late, because we've picked our winners at random. The first place winner is Mary, who gets a Portograph T-shirt, and the second place winner is Diana Too, who gets a set of 6 postcards featuring Ziggy's work. Congratulations to you both. We're taking the rest of September off, but we'll be back in October with an interview with Dr. Dennis Freed, whose dog Genevieve is the author of her own highly amusing book, Small Dog, Big Life, Memoirs of a Furry Genius. Don't miss it. And until then, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288 0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315 849 2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121 288 0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
Why is a toothless dog like a tree? It has more bark than bite.